Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schrankelberg, and Kirk Gray's on the line.
Hey, Fred. It's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Kirk. Just as we're getting started here, we're catching up. We haven't talked in a little while, and you mentioned you saw an article about what, at the time of this recording, is the new Samsung 8. And You know, it sparked a whole slew of ideas on me. So I cut you off there. I apologize and hit record.
That's okay.
All right. So mentioned that somebody was doing some testing for this thing and publishing some claims. So what was that about?
Right. Well, the Samsung, you know, obviously the Samsung is trying to repair itself from its major failure of the, I think, is Galaxy 7 Note.
Galaxy 7 Note that they did that. Caught fire, kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. And it got banned from all those, from every transportation system, including airplanes, and eventually was killed by Samsung as far as they sent out, I think, an operating upgrade or cut them off from use. But obviously they're you know, having to come back with a much better phone and proving it to the world. So the Samsung Galaxy S8 is coming out, and they're starting to see reviews of it. But I saw that Consumer Reports reported that they had passed, the phone had been subjected to a water submersion test of 5 feet for 30 minutes. And, you know, that's kind of certainly you and I would like to know more about the testing conditions and other things. But, you know, was that long enough? And
well, not only long enough.
What would we do?
My first inclination on when somebody reports that, and it's the same when I see it on a data sheet. We passed, you know, IEEE C28715 category B testing. Whoop-dee-doo.
You know, that mil standard 810, is that kind of the thing?
No. It doesn't matter. There's
any spec.
There's a gazillion specs that out there for all, every industry's got a whole slew of them, and Consumer Reports has standard sequence or standards of testing that they do for different. So one of them is it watertight? Can it withstand a normal everyday? You drop it in the pool,
right?
And if you dive down the 5 feet and pick it up, you know, I guess you have to wait till the pool heats up the half hour before you go in and get your pool is kind of the scenario they're using, I guess. I don't know.
But right.
They're saying people drop stuff in water, and if they can get it, they get it usually pretty quick. So we'll pad that a little bit, give it a half hour, and it's got a depth, which increases pressure on it and so on. So we'll say this, if it passes this, it, but they don't say is that it means anything.
Right.
They don't say that in the same with standards. It doesn't equate to this will last now for 5 years or it'll survive water immersion 20 times. It did the test, and under the conditions of the test and the evaluation of it, it'll work. And one client of mine years ago had a device, and they were trying to figure out how to test it for water. And they looked at Consumer Reports, looked at a bunch of other places. And the test was, and I don't know the Consumer Reports one in detail, but the test they decided to do was submerge the device. I think it was in 3 feet of water. And it was like for 10 minutes, and then pull it out, shake off the excess water, and power it up. And if it works, it passes. And so the distance between when it got submerged and when they tested it for functionality was minutes.
Right. And we realized that one cause of failure over a period of time for water immersion would be some potential moisture getting into the phone. It wouldn't immediately cause necessarily a failure, but over a period of time, it may cause a corrosive condition or etching into the circuit or something that will be activated through chemical reaction or through oxidation inside, damage that is takes much longer than, you know, 30 minutes or a few minutes of brushing off the water to manifest itself as a failure. So you're right. And of course, from our perspective, at least my perspective, the thing I would do, and I would expect that somewhere somebody's doing this for all the new phones that are now water resistant, as they're called, and that is continue to increase the depth until you find the depth at which you do have a problem. Either it cracks the glass from pressure, which may not be the case. I don't know how much airspace. There's hardly any airspace in these phones. They're mostly packed completely, but eventually it may break the glass or something like that. And these kinds of, you know, that would be its limit.
But that's for certain failure mechanisms, right? So one of the ways,
for water submersion.
Well, no, seriously, Kirk, is if I can drop a phone into enough water with enough pressure on it that it can crush it, sure. I don't really care. I'm not going to go get that phone at the bottom of the Marianas Trench. Gone, right? But if I drop it at the bottom of my pool, it's got nowhere near the pressure to do this.
No. It's not. It's 12 feet or maybe 10 feet or something like that.
Yeah, it might compromise the seal or get through a port or something like that. I think it's not crushing the system.
No. I say, right. That would be the worst case, but, you know, that's just not water leakage.
Yeah,
but anyway, water immersion and water intrusion into the housing or the circuitry.
Now, back up a little bit. There's almost nothing that we make that is really waterproof.
Exactly.
And so you give it enough time in that sink, for example, right?
Yeah.
Or sitting in the rain or just using it in the shower every day,
right,
is that the vapor pressure alone will diffuse through the material and you'll get moisture internal. Now, so the testing, though, of just dropping it in solid water is liquid water, which has a different diffusion rate than vapor. And at different temperatures. So if I have it in the bathroom with the hot shower all the time, it may fail for internal moisture exposure and corrosion. So saying that it's waterproof is not that terribly meaningful. And this extends to dust incursion, fungus, you know, all the different stresses. If we just test it to a specific level without understanding what's the failure mechanism that's causing the problems, we should be advertising that it's immune to liquid water incursion. The seals are good to this set of criteria. Instead, the advertising is saying it passed this water immersion test. And it doesn't give us as the reader any context of how to interpret that.
Right. But I mean, the advertising is one thing, okay. But what they're doing to test it is another to internally back behind closed doors as they're developing the product. The one thing that I want to know is, and you don't, you know, you just obviously put it in a pressure vessel and simulate the depth of whatever.
Oh, no, not necessarily. I've seen, you know, like Consumer Reports is they have a tube, basically, it's 5 water deep, so they get the
right. Yeah, and that's valid.
It's a lot harder when it's 40 feet, but it can be done.
Yeah, exactly. So you'd build a pressure vessel and have it water and put, and in fact, you'd use a dye penetrant. You know, you'd use a dye that you could possibly disassemble the product and look for water intrusion or dye intrusion, just like we do in semiconductor packaging sometimes, is looking at that way. So that's, you know, hopefully they're doing this in the background, but we'll never find out because you know, if they advertise some of their testing.
Right. Now, the part that we get is like this Consumer Reports article, and they talk about what they actually do. And their intent is to simulate how people really use products to as much as they can, to some extent. Now, the hard part here is that in the Samsung ads, and even the Apple Watch recently, it's all got a bunch of advertising. They're showing people swimming and in the shower or doing whatever.
Yeah, I've seen
those. Is that we have this dilemma in the reliability world is, and you and I know this, is that companies are loath to talk about their product in the context of test of failure or halt testing. Or that it could fail ever and so on. So what happened, though, look at the Samsung guys and Apple also, is the customer base is saying, hey, guys, it's going to get wet. The way I use it, it's going to get wet. You need to make a phone that can deal with that. And don't blame me if it gets wet, because that's just the way it's going to be. And so the Apple and Samsung and others are responding to that. And so the marketing group is saying, we need to let our customer base know that we've addressed this failure mode, right?
Right.
Failures due to water. And the
Probably very common. I mean, it has been one of the number one besides dropping and cracking.
Right. So the marketing guys have to do a good spin on this. So they're showing people using the product in water areas. Consumer Reports, different than most companies. They're not trying to sell the product, right?
No.
They're just saying, here's how we evaluate it, and they reveal some of what they're doing. The issue is that we leave everybody in the dark as to, well, how do I really interpret that? Now, so it gives this perception that the advertising is showing people swimming with the phone, or they drop it in the pool and then they get it out and it's fine. What they don't show is a week later, what you and I would do. We'd put it in an oven and say, let's promote the corrosion. If it's going to, if there's water there, we can promote the corrosion and we can make it fail.
Something where a Arrhenius equation is relevant in the chemical reaction.
Hey, I'm going to.
One place, you know.
I'm going to quote you on that one, Kirk.
See? So, I don't dismiss it totally. But so yes.
You see where I'm at, though, is that the marketing guys are trying to do a good spin on it. Then we support it with these snippets of release of it passed the standard.
Right.
And then it goes that perception that it meets that criteria without enough information to know, under, is it water vapor? Is it overpressure? Is it a hot dashboard? You know, in a moist towel? Is it,
Right.
There's more than one way you can get water in there.
Temperature would also be a factor, because the expansion contraction of the material interfaces, basically the glass, the body, the seals.
They all move.
Right. They all have different thermal capacity.
Consumer Reports isn't doing any preconditioning, right? They're not dropping it 10 times, then doing the water test.
Right. And that's the point. We'd see, I'd go ahead and do initial water test. Then I would maybe do some conditioning. I'd put it back into the water test. I'd keep repeating that possibly with the vibration thermal cycling to expand and contract those seals that basically keep the water out in the phone.
I'd also just sit down and do some calculations that assume the seal is good. It's got a certain distance, a diameter or a length or width to the seal. There is a diffusion rate for moisture. And is it impervious to that? Is it 100 years before you get enough moisture to cause corrosion, or is it 20 minutes? I bet you somebody in designing seals thinks through that stuff. Now, take the seal and put it in the hot sun on a dashboard and let it oxidize a bit. And so it's not as pliable. It may be more less resistant to moisture.
Yeah, it could be become slightly porous or more porous. I don't know.
Yes.
But yeah.
So this Consumer Reports article is pure bunk, and so is all the claims. We don't know.
Okay. I want to. I believe Consumer Reports, they have done, you know, when they, when the new phone came out, I think the guy, it was one of the smartphones, maybe an Apple phone. They talked about how it was more fragile to bending and breaking the glass because, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. especially my daughter, and I've seen most
young people in the pocket.
Women put it in the back pocket and they go sit on it. Okay. Yeah. And so they were saying that they, well, now I think you maybe look this up on YouTube or still see this video that Consumer Reports made where they did actually do a bending halt test mm-hmm. where they got a machine, put it in and increased the force until they actually had the phone physically fold in half or start to fold in half, you mm-hmm. know. Break it. So to be fair, I don't know how much they're doing this with other things, but I have seen that Consumer Reports does a halt type test on certain
objects
or certain mechanisms.
The trouble is that is that force equated to the butt bone sitting on a phone? How
exactly.
much force do you does a, you know, a 100-pound teenager put on a phone?
And how much variation is there in the butt bone and bending and the radius of that? Because that's right. a big factor, too.
So if you're just doing a test and saying, oh, it failed at 3 newtons of force, right. okay, I don't have a context of what that means. You know, if the most I can do when I jump on my phone and when it's sitting on the couch is a half a newton, then 3 newtons is great. But if right. I'm sitting down and I'm a, you know, 50-pound six-year-old and they sit on it and it fractures in half because they put 20 newtons of force on it, well, that's a problem. So that's the problem I have with these marketing and testing and these standards is that the reliability claims are out of context to what's the environmental stresses they're going to see.
What if they, Fred, what if they measured the bending force of several people of different sizes and shapes and, you know, what the forces were, the strain, put mm-hmm. strain gauges on the phone, put it in their backpack and ask them to sit on a hard surface, a soft couch, a bench, you know, those kinds of things.
I've done that kind of work
okay.
with handheld devices.
Okay.
And because we knew that this device was going to be dropped and we knew it was going to be
right.
thrown and we knew it was going to be stepped on and sat on.
Right.
And so we rounded up the development team and we had couches and we had floors and we had walls and we instrumented it up and we broke a bunch of them.
Okay.
And
so you knew where the, you knew what the,
we
the
knew,
in-use forces would be.
We had an idea, a sample.
Okay.
That. And then we said, you know, throw it. Easily, throw it hard, throw it as hard as you can. And we did different prompts and we got a distribution.
Right.
And when we went back to the design world, we said, all right, we saw these kinds of failures and at these kinds of, at the percentile of the distribution we measured.
Right, right.
And then we made a decision that we're going to solve up to this level. And it was, so one of the things we did is one of the questions I had on these handhelds was how often does somebody, it was a gaming console system, is how often do you push the trigger button, the fire button?
Right.
And so
right.
they, their spec was, and from the button vendor was, we tested to 1 million cycles. And so they had a little pneumatic hammer that pounded away at this button
right.
and it would keep working after 1 million cycles. But it was
right.
no variation in force, no variation in
right.
angle, no variation in environmental conditions around it,
right.
and all this other stuff. And I said, well, okay, so what? How often does somebody actually push this button?
Yeah.
And with what forces? And so
right.
we kicked off two studies. One was they had a bunch of people play testing games. They had a lab to
mm-hmm.
bring all kinds of different people in to test. So
right.
We counted. We created a way to capture the information of how often they push the fire button
right.
and different games, different types of users. And we got a distribution and then
right.
we said, oh, geez, you know, here's our calculations. You only push this 800,000 times, you know,
right.
at the 90th percentile of the group. And it was
right.
interesting is the professional gamers, the really, really skilled people
yes.
didn't push it near as much as somebody that was a advanced beginner type.
It you mean was, on the hand controller or whatever the device you
that's right they would
fire a cannon or you fire something in the
right.
or
it, you
shoot
know,
whatever first
yeah.
shooter first-person shooter games.
If you're just spraying and praying on your first-person shooter game, you push the button a lot.
Spraying and praying. I haven't heard that term.
Right. So the idea, though, was, well, let's go measure it. And then we also instrumented it up, and then we said, well, how hard does people push it, and how many use their fingernail versus not? Because it really changes the force distribution.
Right, right.
And so that was a little harder to do because we couldn't do it in gameplay because the...
Right.
But we went and measured that stuff and got samples and created that part of it. So when we reported this button from this vendor is will last for 5 years, it wasn't against some test. It was against the use conditions. And the testing was to give us information about that.
Right. But did you test those buttons to failure or were you able to?
Yeah, was easy to do. Yeah.
A million. I guess you're doing it with an automated system, right?
No, we didn't.
Or a plunger. You had a human push the button until failure?
In some cases, we did because we wanted to capture the amount of variation.
Okay.
Right? And so that was important. And then once we knew what the upper end of that range of forces were, then we automated those things. But we also created, instead of just a straight up and down plunger, we made one that jittered a bunch. It would it would float around and hit it off center, it at an angle,
And
so
In fact, that I've had two situations where I was working for a large company that made PCs, and you know, part of it was how many times is a USB port? How many times is something inserted and removed from a USB port? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's just kind of a roundtable, you know, discussion. Well, we'll come up with this number. And it's rather arbitrary because obviously wide variation in that. Mm-hmm. And there are two situations. I had a technician actually cycle it to that number that we thought was a 3 times what the use condition might be, mm-hmm. and see if there was any failures. But as again, we talked about before, it may not come from just plugging it in and pulling it out. And, you know, you'd have one of the things you'd want to test for later would be fretting corrosion, which obviously can be an effect. Mm-hmm. And it would be on a certain like a connector, a USB connector that stays in as we connect our printers or something like that, stays in over a period of time and moisture or the corrosion on the connector surface starts to be a problem and mm-hmm. cause a high impedance. One of those situations, that wasn't tested for. But another one, I had the developing company had an automated tester, just like you talked about with like a pneumatic plunger, you know, mm-hmm. and it would insert the USB plug into the socket and pull it out. And in the process of developing it, the product or they had reported that the USB sockets had failed. And I found that very unusual after the cycle numbers that they had given. I had not seen this or wasn't expecting it. But then I asked them for a picture of their test configuration or test setup and mechanism. And I saw exactly what you just talked about is that it didn't have any variation. And in fact, it didn't have any feedback. Mm-hmm. So if this...
got jammed, it just banged, it crashed.
That's exactly what
it'd be a hammer pounding it.
Exactly. It didn't know that it wasn't going in the hole, but it was still exerting that force. So eventually it damaged the connector shape so much it couldn't fit into the hole. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously, Fred, some of us would think through that and say, yeah, that's not a valid failure because people don't use a mechanical and they don't. In fact, more importantly, is people will put it at slightly different angles. And that, you know, when they shove it in, also they wouldn't shove it in if it didn't go, if they would manipulate it a little to, if there was some resistance to go in.
Well, my favorite is always you get it wet, you just lick it and it slides in easier. No. Kirk, one of the serious things, though, that comes with this is that, you know, we're talking about ways to get your testing to account for the variability of real-time use, whether it's preconditioning, different angles, different forces, understand the use conditions. Now, we hand that information back to the marketing guys, and we're comfortable saying this phone will be watertight under these sets of conditions, and after 7 days in checking for corrosion, and the seals are tight to this, and it should cover 90% reliable for the 90th percentile of stress conditions that in our scenarios. And they're going to go, it's waterproof. Right?
No.
They don't have the space. They don't have the time. They're not trying to educate.
To put in all the parameters that we have told them.
That's right. Now, to wrap this up, though, I have run into data sheets and sites that actually do a nice job. They create white papers that, are 3 to 10 pages long or something like that. And they explain what they did. Here's the failure mechanism. Here's how we evaluated it against that. Here's how you interpret this for your use conditions. So if you're only do half this number of cycles, here's the formula to calculate the expected time to failure given our test results. Instead of the test results being a one and done or just a margin test, it's more along the lines of the physics of failure, but it gives you enough information. You can say, if I use it if I'm not at the 90th percentile of the use conditions, what's the difference? What can I expect? And in some cases, not all cases, but some cases, we can actually model those things. And if the vendor provides you that information, they are answering that much larger question. They're not just saying, trust us, it's good. We tested it to XYZ standard. They're saying, here's the conditions we used. Here's the, if you use, we used conditions ABC. If you use conditions DEF, here's how you interpret it.
Right.
Now that's value add.
Right. And they know what the mechanisms are that are most susceptible or the leading cause of failure or would be failure. That certainly makes a lot of sense under the basics of the physics of failure of what that device is when it's nominally manufactured. And that's something
that's another whole
other area. Yeah,
that's right. All right. Well, so anyway, I guess our bottom line though, Kirk, is, and to our listeners, is don't believe the advertising. there's usually more to that story. All the way along the line. And we know that as reliability professionals is ask more questions. And if they're using a standard, if the vendor you're working with or the product you're trying to purchase is listing a dozen standards, a really good question back to them is, so how do you interpret that for this use condition? What does that mean? How does that relate to how we use the product? And if they can't answer that, you either need to do the testing yourself or evaluations yourself or find another vendor.
Yeah. So, buy a bunch of phones and see how far they'll go. You're right. Without knowing the details of the test and the conditions of the test, blank statements by the marketing department are blanket statements like this. This is a water, highly water resistant or something. But again, we can't publish what we've tested to exactly what the limits are of the test.
Well,
in other words,
we can. Kirk, you actually can. It's just that it's too much education that comes with it. It's not good marketing.
No.
It's not clear and concise. And the trouble is that enough people are shying away from it that we get misinformation because it gets lost in the interpretation of it. And I think that's where this whole process goes, is that if you're going to make a reliability claim, you need to provide enough backup that it can be supported and understood as where and when it goes. Because 6 months from now, they're going to be getting water ingress problems from one reason or another. And they're going to say, well, it's out of warranty. You got it wet. Or whatever. It's going to be a problem.
No. Well, Apple has told me that with a phone I bought because of a red dot in their connector that indicated water was immersion. So we've now saw, obviously the smartphone market is now addressing that issue. And I think that we'll see blanket, I would imagine, most smartphones becoming very water resistant.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so let's wrap it up there. So thanks
okay. For
the discussion. I knew that there was more to this than just, Consumer Reports did it. We're good. So let's ask our listeners, what's your favorite advertisement claim that you knew is just kind of bollocks? We'd love to hear from you. Head over to reliability.fm. You can find four different podcasts at this time in the network, or four different podcast series. In the Speaking of Reliability area, you can find plenty of ways so you can get in touch with us and let us know what you think. What's the, in particular, what kind of advertising just sets you off? We'd love to hear some of those. And also, do you know of any vendors or suppliers that do a really good job of giving you meaningful reliability information to support their claims? I'd like to hear both of those things. So with that, Kirk, let's wrap this one up.
Okay. Thanks, Fred. We'll hopefully talk to you again soon.
All right.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.